Well, this is the last of our talks, and that is a bit unfortunate, not because the talks are any good, but because the subject is so engaging, and because the subject is so important. It's a very vast subject, and it's a surprisingly unexplored subject, because I've been looking through spiritual literature. Most of the concepts that have been talked about have not been objectified or put into words before, and it was kind of surprising to me. In this talk, I'm not going to try to break any new ground. I'm just going to go over some old things and try to look at them in different ways, and there are a lot of loose ends of things that have been mentioned in other talks that need to be tied in. We'll pick up those fragments, and we'll try that. This little talk will be mostly a series of vignettes that pulls them together, hopefully in a more holistic way. Now, in one of the previous talks, like last night, for example, we said that events are turning points. There are turning points when causes become consequence. There are consequences either in whole or in part, that through an event something is brought to fruition, and that is what changes the consciousness. We'll talk about the importance of that, because if we don't bring things to events, we can't possibly learn from them. There are a lot of people that keep from precipitating events in their lives. In talking about this, we've been talking about cyclical time. Cyclical time and cause and consequence. And we have been mentioning that we humans have gotten out of balance, at least according to the theory of the mysteries. We're out of sync with the cosmos, or with the intended form that the cosmos was supposed to take. And because of this, we have made the workings of destiny much more difficult. In fact, we've made them unpleasant for ourselves, so that we talk about this cause and consequence, most people think of things that are punishments and things of that order. So let's begin to look at cause and consequence in a materialistic state, and try to do so a little bit in terms of the bigger picture. Now, in Orthodox Christianity, there's a notion called the burden of sin. And some Orthodox Christians tie this notion together with what is called original sin. And under this brace of notions, we're all born into sinful ways because of the original sin of Adam and Eve. So if we were to take that in a normal materialistic way, not including the principle of rebirth and such like that, not even an innocent baby, would be innocent. And it would be, like everyone else, doomed to perdition unless there was an individual exception, acceptance of Christ, and in that acceptance, one would have to more, and one would have salvation. It's a pretty far-fetched concept, outlook on life. Yet it isn't a very likable combination. It doesn't seem fair, especially for the baby. We should be able to, according to that way, be able to start life with a clean slate. And that's not very fair at all. And everybody, every little bird that came into the world would be doomed because of something that somebody else did a long, long time ago. When you encounter a concept in a system like this, it's like an experience we all had back in grade school, when everybody had to stay after class because one or two people acted up. And there were a couple of troublemakers, and everybody had to pay for that. Now, people who have this belief do not believe in rebirth. consider it a pagan heresy. It's a heathen thing. And the logic of it, of course, is why of the devil. And they balk and they take offense at the idea of us ourselves having been what is symbolized by the original Adam and Eve, and that we have compounded our original mistakes and have turned them into sinful and destructive acts over many millennia. So consequently, many of the Orthodox followers of Christ are apt to believe in something that really doesn't have a satisfactory explanation, which isn't totally bad. It's good to believe in something, especially if it's something positive and that there is a hope and that something that you can be redeemed. But like many things, there is a grain of truth in these beliefs, and that truth is helpful for us to understand our own view of rebirth and consequence and the way we see the fall into materialism. Now the fact is that we did disobey. We really did go against the concept. It wasn't like we were just out rebels, but we allowed ourselves to be seduced into actions that went against things that were made known to us that are not individual evolutionary actions. As a consequence of our not participating because we in a harmonious way, because we are part of the creative hierarchies, we have skewed the whole evolutionary process. We have taken a trajectory that has taken us deeper into matter than it was intended, and it has limited our consciousness because we are blind to spiritual things. We preferred experience over insight. And when that's the case, we do not have insight or look for insight in all of the experiences, and we have to make the same dumb mistakes over again and again, which is something that we're all quite prone to. Whereas if we get it and we've got the insight into ourselves, the way things are, we don't continue to make those kinds of mistakes. So in fact, we have retired the process of the cosmological process and our participation in it by taking in a deeper course of materialism. And it is also a grain of truth that over many millennia, because we have removed ourselves from intuition and keep on making mistakes and sometimes making them more seriously, we keep trying to get rid of the same people over again and again without realizing they're going to come back. And because we make those kinds of mistakes, we have accumulated a backlog of unredeemed destiny, which you could call a burden of sin if you wanted to, and that would be a perfectly just way to do it. Very few people, in terms of the things that really count, in terms of moral character, very few people pass through life giving more than, doing more positive than they have done negative. Just think of all of this, in terms of the environment alone, all of the positive that we have put into the environment and the detrimental effect that it has on it. So our cyclical journey through time in all of this, we've become stronger. So we have had to deal with more materialistic circumstances. And as we become stronger, we can take back, or we can redeem more that unregenerated burden that we have of consequences that we haven't been strong enough to redeem before. So the way we have crippled ourselves. Now, this is all done by the divine part of our being, and the divine part of our being works in accordance with divine hierarchies, some of which are called recording angels or lords of destiny or something of that nature, and they help us plan our future lives in such a way that we can be more efficient. So if we learn even just a simple thing of being cooperative, our evolution goes much faster. Now, they have brought to a head precisely the things we need to know at precisely the right times. And that is why destiny is so perfect, because it is poetic justice, such that even though we may say, oh, not now, this should be happening now, right now is the right time, and we're walking precisely what we need, exactly what we needed. Now, there are a number of things that are in this. That is that there are different times in a cycle that are more appropriate for different kinds of destiny experiences. Now, it's a shame, but some of the ways we learn the best are through illnesses. And it isn't until our misthoughts, our misemotions, and our misdeeds become crystallized in our body as conditions that are illnesses that it becomes indubitable to the spirit that we have been making a mistake and that we have been living wrong or uncooperatively or something like that. Now, there are some kinds of illnesses that we only need to experience. And those kinds of illnesses are best in childhood, like superficial illnesses, like mumps and measles and chicken pox and things like that. We experience them when we're young, and we get the experience because we don't need anything more. However, if there is an illness that is ours to ponder on, and in the pondering, we begin to understand in our soul what we have been wrong and how we have been living wrong. Usually those are the kinds of illnesses that come late in life. Because as children, we don't have the capacity to understand them. And in the middle part of life, we're not psychologically prepared. And we have so many things going on that we don't take the time to ponder them. So this is a reason, one of the reasons why older people have more illnesses is because they can benefit more from them. It's obvious from this point of view that if you're on the spiritual path, it is a badge of merit to have a whole bunch of illnesses. Because it means you're discharging a lot of past destiny, and it means that you are ready to call back things from the past and clear the record, and at the same time, build soul material into your very being. And so that's the difference then between illnesses in old age and illnesses in childhood. Now, if we look at things in this way, our sins of our past are not just something ugly that we get rid of. Our experiences like that become the fertilizer, or the manure, so to speak, for new and better growing in the spiritual way. So this is what we mean when we are, by our strength of character, ripening our past destiny and bringing things to a place that we can learn and do things from them. Now, the way this works, I have a nephew that has hiked the Pacific Crest Trail all the way from the Mexican border to the Canadian border. And along the way, there are what are called drop-off points. At certain times, you go down and you get the materials and the foods that you need. You can't carry on your backpack everything that you need to go all the way from Mexico to Canada. And so there are drop-off points. And when we're talking about periods when there are ripenesses and we can go back and pick up things that we have stolen beforehand, like squirrels or like Pacific Crest hikers, there is a whole kind of destiny that is of this kind. All right. We're talking about maturation in time and process of culminating consequences in time and space of destiny that we have that is not fulfilled yet. Now, we've been noting that causes issue from the more spiritual part of ourselves. The more spiritual part is the creative part, and actually all causes begin as creative impulses. And we externalize something as far as it needs to be externalized, which in some cases is no further than a thought. And sometimes things we externalize all the way to the material world, and then they result as events in the material world in the interplay of matter with spirit. In the interplay of that, the experience is born where matter is spiritualized and taken back into our character, into our spiritual being. So we say then that causes come from an internal source, and when they become consequences, it is external. In time and space, you might say, we're not using time and space, physics use it. Time is the potential within which spirit is manifested. Space is the potential in which matter is manifested. Space is matter. It's a little bit difficult to explain because we have a whole bunch of people that are new in and are not familiar with using. So this may sound all very confusing to me. It's not all because the presentation is confusing. It's because the vocabulary. So the experience of reality, as thoroughly as it is possible to be experienced, is what is important. We're talking about constructs of time and space, which are intellectual ways that we understand potential, and potential is a fancy way of something that could be, whether it's the potential that is behind the dam, or whether it is the potential of something that could become matter in mathematical space. Now, if we observe ourselves, we can note that we seem to experience these constructs simultaneously. If we're clock watchers and we're just trying to get through the day to finish and fill up our 8 hours or whatever it is that we work, we tend to look at time in a linear fashion. This is the beginning of the day, and this is the end of the day, and there's a sort of a restless, fidgety quality watching the clock. If we are cyclical people, if we are like farmers, or if we are people that are in touch with nature, the cycle of the seasons, or the cycle of the day from morning to night, we have a different view of time, and we have a different view of consciousness. It's still the same time, the same potential in which things are born, whether we're looking at it linearly or whether we're looking at it cyclically. Probably, it's less restless and more peaceful to work with cyclical time, because if you think about first light in the morning and the way it eases its way into dawn, and then there's that first crack of sun that comes across the horizon that's almost shocking, and then the sun becomes stronger and stronger, and this time of year, it's almost unbearable. And then it dwindles, and then you have it sets, and then there's a twilight, and then eventually you have night that comes and troubles your experience of your consciousness. And that is a much more gentle or a much more gradual outlook of time and destiny because of the way you relate to time. If we try to experience cyclical time as a whole, the whole day as one thing, or the whole year as one year as a total, or has one rebirth. From one rebirth to the next rebirth, that's something that's much more difficult. One reason is that it's a very slow process. If we take our life, it takes decades to mature and to have continuity of consciousness and to apply ourselves that we are awake and alert and watching the process all the time is quite a feat. If a person has that kind of will that they can hold their consciousness in a state of alertness and watchfulness, that's quite an individual. Most of us have lapses where we even try to retreat from being in consciousness. So very few people have the consciousness that they can follow the whole cycle, the part that is including the part that is invisible to us now, the part that is after death and that is before birth. So for most of us, even if it's logical and even if it is intuitively true to us, the life cycle in its completeness seems to be hearsay to us. It's hearsay that is aided by intuition, and it's even reasonable that we can understand something. Now, there's a reason why it's helpful to know about cause and consequence. If we understand that everything in this cycle, including the cycle itself, is a moment of cause and consequence, we can get much more out of it. We can understand there is a purpose and there is a reason for everything that happens in our life. Now, the life cycle, as we mentioned last evening, has a very broad dimensionality. And by a broad dimensionality, we mean that it passes through various dimensions of our consciousness. Last evening, when we were talking about this in a little bit different way, we said that causes become consequences in events, and that the events are more likely to be external relative to the subject. Now, in a life cycle, like the cycle of cause and consequence, that cycle is analogous to the cycle of introversion and extroversion. In the cycle of introversion and extroversion, we're doing that continuously, whether we know it or not. A really good example is if we're driving down the highway, and we're going to pass a car, or we're just going along down the highway, we're continuously watching. We're watching the cars that come up from behind. So we are externalizing our consciousness. And as we draw information from the external world, we also internalize it. So there is an introversive stream and an extroversive stream. And when we take information from the external world, the spirit in us, the truth knower, we intuitively come to conclusions. We don't calculate it all in our minds. Sometimes we do. If we're going to pass another car, we form a judgment about whether we're capable of passing that car or not. So that is a cycle that is going on as long as we are awake. We're looking outside, taking information in, making conclusions, and acting accordingly. And so it's a constant cycle of externalization and internalization. Well, the same thing is true of the life cycle, only on a much more grand scale. It is something where the introversion is complete and the extroversion is as complete as we are capable of. Oh boy. In either case, the cycle begins within. In the case of the life cycle, it begins with a creative impulse. It begins when we are at one with ourselves as spiritual beings. We are at one with ourselves as the body. And since we are spiritually in the image of the spirit, the idea that we are is a miniature of the cosmos. And when we are filled with the idea of the cosmos, we become so infused and we become so desirous of participating that we precipitate a new life. We come back to birth. We say, I want to be part of this. I want to do something. And so we externalize things. And we put things out. And our lives are never what we want them to be, just like our paintings are never what we want them to be, because we are as yet imperfect creators. And even if we were perfect creators, there's always the unknown. Something can't be a potential if it's already known, because that's a known. That's not something that could be, that's something that is. So in the ongoing scheme of things, there is always an ever-becoming. There is always something new that is being learned. And so we produce a life that is filled with material consequences. And then we take those consequences, the essence of the experiences, back into our being. And so you might say, it's a perfect example that some people use when they talk about cause and consequence. They say, the chickens come home to roost. Now, in these cases, we can see that spiritual causes become concentrated and they become specific consequences to events. Whether the event is an 80-year lifetime here on Earth or whether it is an event of having accomplished something, like making my garden for the year or something like that. Now the way we're looking at this is quite stripped down, very simplified, and we're doing that just so we can get the skeletal ideas. And when we have the skeletal ideas, if we're watching our lives, we are not only taking in data, we have the skeletal principles, we can flesh them out from the experiences of our life, and then our life becomes something that's more full and something more meaningful. So we say an event is a concentrated cause. Sometimes when that cause becomes a consequence after the event, the concentration stays with it and it continues on to cause something else. We talked about that last evening. And it is a cause that becomes so materialized that it becomes as dense as it can be to the point that it's almost inert. And as a consequence, when something becomes an event and it is so concentrated, there's a kind of purity. There's a kind of guilelessness. We can't say that an event that differs between a cause and a consequence that comes back to us, it's not loaded. It is not tendentious. It's not a slanted thing, because the concentration that produces an event in destiny is pure concentration in reality. And this is why we say that cause and consequence is not something that is like punishment, and that we say that God is a respecter of persons. Is a concentration of our most divine being in a way that is materialized in such a way that there's no room for falsehood in it. An event is so objectively impermeable that it echoes back the objectivity. It echoes it back to the causal spirit as perfect feedback. Creative feedback in such a way that it is simple and undeniable. Even if it was only semi-conscious, or even if our creative dream, as wonderful as it was, didn't understand the full of what we were doing, when it gets echoed back to us, it's echoed back to us in a way that we can see everything that was there all the while. As far as it can go. Now, it's interesting in this, when you get to things that are so simple, so basic, so fundamental, they're almost always paradoxical, and they're almost always ironic. It is such a thing that when a cause becomes a consequence, it becomes a consequence in the densest state possible for that cause. And in that densest state of, so to speak, ignorance, is where we get our greatest enlightenment. It's sort of like on the same principle when you're teaching something. If you have a student that is not very bright, in order to bring the information to that student, you have to really bring it to them. You learn a lot in and from yourself by trying to teach something to the dense student. And that's actually the way we teach ourselves in the process of cause and consequence. It's an irony. It's not a hard, cold, sardonic kind of irony, but it's more like a poetic justice. Now, we've been mentioning all along that not all spiritual causes mature to the same degree of concentration and materialization to be fulfilled in order to get cosmic feedback. There are probably cosmic formulae for determining the consequential ripeness of something, but that's something that is way beyond my intellectual capacity, and I can talk about it. I know it's there, and somebody will think about it probably already, and he'll come up with an answer that I have been unable to try to get to at this point. When we ripen causes, what I'm trying to say, it's not like a technical formula. We know how ripe it should be and when it is ripe through the process of intuition. Whether it is a social sense or an artistic intuition, all we need to do is know the sense of completeness, the fullness. There is, you know, when there is a completion of a cause becoming a consequence, you don't have to overdo. You know it's there and it fits just right. It's sort of like what you would call the Goldilocks principle. Not too much, not too little, but just right. Destiny is like that. Our lives are like that. It's fulfilling. If you do such a simple thing as playing golf. When you try to push a shot, you hook it, and if you are sliding across it, you slice it, but when you hit a shot right, there is a feel to it. There's a feel of completeness. And something like that is what it feels like in life when we have a cause that we live by or there's something that we're trying to accomplish. We get a sense of what it is supposed to be. Don't want to carry things too far because that just generates other consequences that are certainly not what are desired, and what we learn are unnecessary lessons made necessary by our stupidity, I guess. Now let's go to the life spirit in which all of this occurs. I'm going to have to bypass because it's not if I don't do a little byways, then all the other people will have to be patient. There are antecedent realms inside the dense physical world. Mystics of all ages have found out that this material world is suspended within a realm of life and energy and vitality. Christian philosophy, we call that the etheric subdivision of the physical world. And antecedent to that, and the extending much deeper into space, given what space becomes so meaningless here, you see an aura, you're not seeing an aura in this space, it's clear that you're seeing an aura in a different dimension, and it is associated with the physical body in this space, but it's a different dimension. Is the desire world and the desire body, which is a world of motivation. In the same way that space in the etheric sense is permeated with all kinds of energy, beyond that, in a much more subtle way, everything is permeated with emotion, feeling, and desire. Beyond that is a world of concrete thought. Behind every motivation, there is a reason. That reason is of thought. The behind that, we get to the transcendental spheres, which are called the true spiritual worlds. Beyond that is the region of ideational thought, where we have universal principles. And those universal principles are at the same time universal, but not quite concrete, like the world of thought, the desire world, and coming all the way down this, to this world, there's concretion. So they're universal, but they do have limitation. Like every principle can usually be described by a formula of some type. It's a scientific principle. It's described by a mathematical formula. If it is a principle that is of character, it's usually described by a story, like a grand myth or something like that. So the principles are something that you would say each of them is a truth. And it is a truth that is universal, but it is a truth. And that realm subsists within an even greater realm called the realm in Western philosophy is called the region of life spirit, which is truth, pure light. Like the light, when you have an idea, that idea, the lights go on in your consciousness. It's not this kind of light. It's a light of intelligence, spiritual intelligence. And that pure light and that pure love, it's the selfness out of which all the selves are developed. Because the selves are merely ideas. They are divinely conceived ideas, but they are conceived out of life spirit. Now, there are regions beyond this, but this is as far as we want to go. The being that we know as Christ, who is not Jesus, something similar to us. I know that some of you are more interested in Oriental philosophies. It is something similar to the concept of the avatars, as incarnations of Vishnu. And in the Hindu community, Vishnu is the same thing as life spirit, complex. And Christ being as focusing from life spirit, could say something like, I am the truth. And he was speaking that truly. And he says, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Meaning to say that you will be able to transcend or give your consciousness over to that pure truth and even be beyond yourself. We're talking about a being here that is a being of altruistic love. This means that there is freedom from the law, and because the region of ideational or abstract thought and all the phenomenal regions are suspended within life spirit, it is freedom within the law. This also means that newness or freedom can be interjected into cause and consequence at any time, because it is beyond time and because it is creatively free. This is probably the most important concept that we've talked about all week. In the Christian religion, it is called grace. And being in a state of grace is knowing the truth, and knowing the truth in such a way that you can live it and that you can live creatively because you're living in the ultimate purpose and truth for everything that exists. Because everything that exists from the ideas down to the phenomenal world are creations from that universal spirit. And if you are functioning from that, and if you are bringing that into your life, everything is new. A person who lives in a state of grace, either partially or just now and then has intuitions, has a completely new view of life every day. We've all had that experience reading something like the Bible or some other book that is very, very filled with spiritual wisdom. We read a passage and then we read it again a year or so later, and it's like we've never read it before. It's new. The newness is not in the book. The newness is in us. And this is a sign that we have been living successfully spiritually because that newness or that truth can come through us. This means, with regard to the principle of cause and consequence, that we can change anything. Some things are harder to change, but the deeper that we go into love, the deeper that we live in truth, which means fulfill the purpose of it all the more we can change in our lives. And if we can't change it, we can live it and we can get more out of it. If we are forgiven, it doesn't mean that cause and consequence is nullified and that all your causes are meaningless and that all the energy is taken out of it. That is not true. If you are forgiven, you will receive the wisdom and understanding that you would have received if you had gone through those causes and consequences and suffered everything that came from them, so that you can then interject into them something that is very creative, something that is very new. So what we're talking about here is the love wisdom principle of life spirit is timeless. It means that we have virtually a stop action of anything and everything. On the fly, we can be as if we have an eternal amount of time to do things. This actually happens to us in our bodies. And they talk about it in terms of brainwaves. If you get into a certain kind of excitement of brainwaves, everything slows down. I have a friend that used to be on the Detroit Police Force, and he was, at one time, he had to take out three people who were trying to kill him. It was on a drug bust, and he said, everything was so fast that it slowed down, and I could see what I had to do first and what followed after that, meaning you would get to that kind of consciousness. Now, I don't want to talk about phenomena like that much, but that's just for an example. And this means that everything can be lived creatively, everything brand new, and even though we may have to go back to a mess that we made for ourselves, we're forgiven in that we no longer have to accept the hand-drawn destiny or the violent attitude or the violent attitude that we had that got us into a stew that we needed to be forgiven of. So this is the principle of grace is an exceedingly important principle. Doesn't mean that the law is suspended, it means that it's fulfilled. The biblical Christ, during the 3 years ministry, when the Christ worked through the body of Jesus, that being said, I come not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. All right, we're getting back now to talking about where we left off and probably lost again. We're living in a more purposeful way. And our lives are all about purposefulness. And we can see things, and we can see things such that there is no barrier between past and future, or between cause and consequence, because we are in a realm that transcends time. And this brings up a subject, it's going to be a difficult subject to talk about, but well, let's talk about irreversibility. Physics has a notion, mathematical physics has a notion that time is reversible, and that may very well work in formulae, but it doesn't work in existence, because once you have had an experience in time, once you have brought a cause to a consequence and you have experienced that, you are changed forever. And you can try to reverse time, but who would ever want to reverse or wipe out everything that they've ever learned? Because most of the things that we learn, and ultimately all of them, are basically good. So what we're talking about here is, how to say it. How to work with chains of causes and consequences within time by working from a timeless state. To do that, let's look at the extreme difference of cause and consequence, one of life and death. But let's talk about the death side. In fact, let's talk about pre-death. Because something can't die if it hasn't been born. And so here we go. I'll probably have all kinds of people up in arms at me, but we're going to talk about abortion. Now, for a person who is a trained clairvoyants in the course of their spiritual career follow the entire path of an entire life right down to every cell division. For example, Max Heindel, the trained seer that was the founder of the Rosicrucian Fellowship, knew exactly what the first two cells that were differentiated when the sperm met the ovum. He said that the first cell that is differentiated in the embryo is a heart cell, and that the second is a pineal cell. And no doubt the heart cell is the cell that contained the history of all of our past physical rebirths, going all the way back to different stages of the solar creation when we were mineral-like. Every form that we've ever taken, the essence of that is carried in our heart. And no doubt the second cell carried the essence of every vital experience that we've ever had, going all the way back to when we were plant-like. So if somebody has followed every cell division from conception to birth and followed every incident in a person's life, there's not a question about, like the Supreme Court has to say, when does life begin and when doesn't it begin? Because this is something that is a known, it's something that can be. Actually, clairvoyant investigations go so far back, they go back to the original archetype when the spirit thought out what was going to become the life and what was going to become the world that life was manifest in. Now, we're talking about streams of causes and consequences. And when it is, we've talked about redirecting a cause so that it does not have a harmful effect, and now let's talk about interrupting. Sometimes we want to interrupt certain streams of causal activity. Probably the best example is we want to quit smoking if we're smoking. And we have activities that we get into that are very destructive, and the quicker that we can quit them and transform the energy into something else, the better it is. So if we're talking about abortion, in the stream of causality that is producing that child, abortion is not the time to stop it. In the first place, an entity is working to come to birth. Nature is working to accomplish something. Divine beings are working to accomplish something. And the act of abortion is thwarting all of that. And it's not something that is taken quite easily by the person who does that. So birth control is a much more viable thing. You go further back in the chain of causes, and you get birth control before the conception takes place, and at least you're not bucking nature. But with birth control, we have a problem that we talked about in one of the earlier talks. Birth control is sex without fulfilling the purpose of sex, which is very hard, is a very big temptation. We want to cause the pleasure, but we do not want the consequence of having the sexual act fulfilled. And consequently, if we pleasure ourselves and make a habit of pleasuring ourselves, which I think everyone in this room probably does, you're developing an attitude that is very selfish, and it's bringing you to be a harmonious, an adharmonious part of the cosmos, especially when you're dealing with the creative force, which is a very powerful force. So it is much more advantageous to get it when it's a desire. That is to get it before the desire gets stopped, or if you have the desire to stop it at that point. And that's not easy. It's probably as hard as riding a Brahma bull, no hands, with nothing to hang on to. Or it's is probably as hard as trying to catch a fish with oiled hands, reaching into the stream and grabbing it. It's not easy. Being able to catch the thought before the thought becomes a desire is much more easy, because the thought of our minds are still at a very early state of their development, and they're much closer to the spirit. And even if in spirit we are not extremely well evolved, in spirit we have a better chance of controlling our thoughts. It's one of the first things that we do in spiritual exercises, is get in control of our thoughts so that we're not seeding our whole personality with a bunch of bad thoughts. Ideally, the place to catch it is when the creative impulse comes from life spirit before it becomes an idea or is injected into an idea. If we do something like that, we have, in the chain of causation, we are at the ground floor. We're at where things begin ab initio. And this is the place that it is wisest for us to control our creative thoughts. All right, now. So that's one of the little vignettes for the evening. I'm trying to. Since we have a lot of other loose ends from earlier talks and things that I got started, it's. This, we have to tie a few more of them up while we have a little bit of time. And that means this will be a little bit longer talk. It'll be probably about an hour and 15 or 20 minutes rather than just an hour. We brought up something yesterday called indirect control. When we are in our bodies looking out at the world, we have a very limited perspective. And because we are not always in the spirit and we live in our petty little personalities, the viewpoint in our bodies is a subjective point of view. It is as though we're looking out at the world as something that is foreign and something that is unknown. If we are in third heaven, in that place where we are divine beings, and in the same sense in the threefoldness or in the attribution of the idea that is ourself in the highest sense, that is the same as God. And so when we are there, we have a much different perspective of things. We understand the universe as a whole, we understand ourselves as a whole, and we understand our life as a whole. Everything is familiar, especially if we are in our selfhood and we are united with life spirit, which some people would call to be in communion with Christ. Everything is then familiar, because it is all part of that one pure universal spirit. I'm having a hard time the concentration after a whole week. I'm having a hard time concentrating that much. In that state between life spirit and human spirit, cause and consequence are just two sides of the same thing. Everything is unified. That's what universal spirit means. It's all one thing. And everything is at a state of oneness. When we're in the personal body, when we're in this, looking at things, there are so many different things, it's hard to believe that everything is all related. And the fact of bringing the spirit all the way into this world so that the unity of all of the differential expressions in the world is possible is really quite an accomplishment. In reality, the future, the consequences that will be in this world, we see all as one if we are in life spirit. But the way it appears here, it appears that the future is moving toward us as much as we are moving toward the future. That's what the subjective point of view means. Now, this has been something that has been all in all schools of spiritual philosophy. The Greeks, for example, called it Titanic time, in that the Titans, who had the higher state of consciousness and went from end to, went from effect to cause, they saw things in the opposite way we see things. If you remember the stories of Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, Merlin got younger and his life went backwards because he lived in Titanic time. In fact, he was looking toward ends and not toward beginnings, and went backwards in that way. Now, the future is very broad. The more we go into the future, the more it could be anything. And the future remains broad until we make it something specific. We take something very abstract out of potential, out of a myth, for example, and we make it history. Actually, it is so broad that it is everything that the one concrete point that is right now in the moment isn't. That is, it bears the same relationship that the general spirit has to the personality. So the future is more like an expression of the universal spirit, in the same way that we in the personality are in the expression of time. I don't know how to say this. If we are focused in the present, and if we are well within the realms of time, which are realms of concentration, it seems as if we are impelling ourselves toward the future, and that the future is rushing toward us. And in moments, again, this is where a cause becomes a consequence. In moments, in those specific events, is where the general and the specific meet. And it is that that brings the understanding or the meaning out of events of cause and consequence. So it is important to participate in both kinds of consciousness to get the full experience, and to be efficient in the way that we live our lives. And that is a matter of control. Now, we're very familiar with personal control, because there are times that we can be forbearant and keep ourselves from doing things that we have learned are not wise to do, and we can be, you know, the automobile is a good example of control. We have an accelerator that we can speed up, and we can use the energy more or less efficiently with different gears, and when we need to, we can stop. And I think the stopping mechanism has to be 7 times stronger than the propelling mechanism, so for safety reasons, that we have control that we can stop. So this is a direct control. But when we practice concentration, all the forces of the spirit are brought to bear on what we are concentrating on. And when we concentrate and we bring things to an event or to a moment of experience, at that time, the spiritual part of our being is activated and it becomes alive at the same time that the personal part of our being is purified in concentration, so that we have only one thing on our mind and we can penetrate through it. So in the process of our spiritual exercises, when we are bringing concentration to bear as perfectly as we can, We are like the moments of cause and consequence. The personal part of us is in the concentration, but we can transfer our consciousness if we watch ourselves when we are concentrating. Our consciousness gets transferred to that excited, universal, spiritual part of our being. And what happens then is that we have an experience that is like, we've all had it at some level or another. There is even a phrase in our language about it. God is in its heaven and all is well. We have that feeling that even if there is bedlam going on around us, we feel very much at peace, and if there is something that requires action, we're ready for it. In fact, the causal stream, or the events of our lives, can be affected from that universal consciousness just as much as we can affect it in focusing on the deeds that we do. And this is what is called indirect control. And it seems as if we are doing nothing, but everything is getting accomplished. This is what it means for things to be accomplished spiritually. This is something that we are trying to bring about by our spiritual exercises so that we're whole people, that we aren't just personalities and that we aren't blissed out people that are that have transcended, which means escaped all phenomenal reality, but we are capable of functioning in both at the same time, so that we are capable of fulfilling the divine purposes for existence and carrying out our duty and finalizing things here in this world. This is something that is very important. This is taking a state of grace, the most universal kind of consciousness that we can awaken, and bringing it to bear on the things that we do in our everyday life. Let's look at one last little vignette. And it's not to explain any great ideas. It's more or less a description. And it is a description to put things a little bit more into perspective with our experience, even though I think we've all experienced all the things we've been talking about, that we haven't put it in these kinds of words. We've been discussing cyclical time, and cyclical time is continuous. The cycle of introversion and extroversion is continuous. The life cycle is continuous. Now, if we combine linear time, where we keep going straight in a line toward the future, but that line curves so that it is also cyclical, what we have is spiral time. The question then comes up, what kind of spiral is the spiral time that we enter into when we are evolving? Because we're involved in a, from the cellular level of our bodies to the revolution of the galaxy, everything in our existence is a composite of many, many cycles working together. And we want to understand so that we get a feel of what our existence is like, what kind of spiral. Well, depending on what we're talking about, there are different kinds of spirals. Because in the ability to control our thoughts, and in the ability to concentrate so that we can do things in the world, not even magical things, we make very little progress. I don't think I'm any different than anyone else in this room, but for about 46 years I've been working on trying to concentrate, and I've made progress, but when I compare it to the expectations I have that I had for myself when I was young, my progress is pitiful. All of that work to get only so little ahead. And then you have to filter all the things that would have happened anyway because of the aging process, because the experience of life wakens things in us. But our progress is extremely slow. So if we look at the cycle of progress, the spiral is like a spiral of Archimedes. it starts with a really tiny center, and you're just barely making any progress, and then gradually it opens up, and it opens up, and it opens up. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. This is what happens when we once get a toehold on spirituality, when we once get to make a breakthrough, when we get through all of these little spinnings and we get a hold of ourselves and we no longer do destructive things, and we know how to bring our personality so that it is open and receptive to intuition and other divine things so that we can live a more heroic or godlike existence, then it starts to grow faster and faster. And when we turn more of the burden of sin into creative potential, the spiral really opens up. In terms of rebirth and in terms of the cycle of moving forward, most people see it as a helichord spiral. But what kind of helichord spiral? That's important. Most of us think it is an open helichord spiral, something like this. Well, maybe if you're out here on the spiral of Archimedes, it is a spiral that is open and progressing rapidly. But it's, in reality, it's far from that. It's a tight spiral. Now, there are some things that I like theoretically that I don't like, or it's very hard for me to take in reality. Do you know what minimalist music is, like the music of Stephen Reich? The music of Stephen Reich is like the spiral that is our progress now. Minimalist music is something where a theme is developed and it's repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated. It has an almost trance-like quality. And then after several minutes of many, many, many repetitions, it changes a little bit. And that is what our life cycles are like. That is what our daily cycles are like. And it isn't bad, because we don't make the progress that we want to make and that we think we should be making, we feel bad. It's really not. Because if we're making a tight helichord spiral so that it's, really close altogether, it means our experience is filling up space so that we have as close to complete coverage or complete saturation as we can. And so the lesson that destiny teaches us is patience. If we want to have a more open spiral, or if we want to be able to creatively influence and fulfill the purpose of what we are in, that will come to us. But it will only come to us when we have the kind of patience that it takes to learn from each and every cycle. This is why we try to live longer. We don't try to live longer because we're desperately hanging on to life. We try to live longer because each moment is very precious. And each moment is a potentially enlightening moment. And each moment we have more that we can give to the ongoing creation and cosmos. So that's about as much as I have to say. I have one regret in all of this, except for the few minutes that we had this evening of talking about the principle of grace. We have, this was meant to be a series of talks on love and the law. That is grace and the cause and consequence, how they work together and how the former can be brought into the latter. But I got so engaged in trying to understand cause and consequence and putting all these thoughts together from years that I didn't get there. So maybe in a few years' time we can have a series of talks completely on grace. For now, let's close with the Rosicrucian student's prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Any questions? No kidding. Yes.
What was that hang of destiny? What is that? What does that
mean? It's a colloquial idiom. If a person has a hangdog attitude, they have a long face and they feel everything is wrong, and they feel that nothing is going to be right. It's the kind of attitude that a blues singer has, except without the redemption from singing the blues. It's a dour, negative kind of attitude. If you remember, did you ever see the comic strip Little Abner? In there was a character called Joe Bofisk. It was a name that had no vowel in it. And Joe Bofisk had a hangdog attitude, and he had his own private rain cloud, and everybody else would be walking around in the sun, and it would be raining on him. So that's, yeah. Yes? Yes.
Now there are a lot of versions in the world with a lot of
versions
that are good, better, different, whatever. But what kind of a charter, what kind of a destiny would a person have
that does?
That would be afforded as well as, you know what I mean?
Yes. I have some experience with that. I have some friends. I have two friends that have had as many as 3 abortions. And my experience is that for the person who aborts, if they're a sensitive person especially, it's killing to their consciousness. One of my friends that had 3 abortions, it must have been about 35 years ago, it took that long, and she's just now starting to come out from the self-hatred that she had for doing that. It's one of those things that, you know, both were women that felt they couldn't do it alone, and the man wasn't going to be there, and they're both very femmes, extremely feminine women, and they look to have a counterpart to help them carry through the pregnancy and all. And it left emotional scar tissue that was horrendous. I suspect that if you're trying to frustrate something that is fundamental, you don't buck nature easily. And when the cells have started dividing and the natural forces have been put to work to accomplish something, if you try to, we try to buck nature right now, in ancient times, people would say when there was a plague, they would pray and say, what have we done wrong? And let's try to understand that. Now what we do is we push it further away. We put out all kinds of insecticides and things like that, and then we get cancer. And then how do we try to deal with the cancer? We try to deal with chemotherapy and such like that. You're bucking nature in each of those cases. You're choosing death rather than life. When you have something like an illness, you have 2 options. You have either to strengthen the host or to kill the enemy. And we choose always the path of death, of killing the enemy, whether it's the bugs or whether it's the cancer, we try to do it that way. And when you get into that set of consciousness of frustrating, it is the frustration works hard for both people. Person does not feel fulfilled because they have not carried the fetus to term, and the person crying to come to birth is in the same situation. It is said, though I can't verify it because I don't have the equipment to do that, that the people who are aborted were themselves aborters in the past, and that this is one of those kinds of destiny that is a tit for a tat kind of a destiny, or an eye for an eye kind of destiny. I can't say.
But then they would choose the parent knowing that that would happen to them?
Yes. In some cases, it is intentional. They know they're going to be aborted. But those are a special class of cases. I've run into several of those. Most notably, if the future parent has the wrong attitude about life, usually an anti or aspiritual attitude toward life, sometime the incoming entity will come to the person and die in childhood or will die in a miscarriage. And sometimes they'll do that three times, maybe even more, that they'll die in early childhood until the parent senses that this is the same being. And that changes the consciousness. And then the person becomes a more of a spiritually believing person because they have their own private experience through life and death of the continuance of the spirit. And when they change their attitude and live a more spiritual life, then the person comes to them, is born to them, and stays. There are cases on record where people have done that as many as three times. Okay, any other questions? I'm open for anything.
Oh, I wanted to say you went to clairvoyance.
There's a difference. There are different grades of clairvoyance. The word clairvoyance means clear seeing. And you can be clairvoyant on any realm. You can even be physically clairvoyant. Sometimes you look with your physical eyes and you're only looking and then your perception is like the perception that the physiologists say. It's all receptive. But sometimes you look and you see. You look at something and when you look at it, you connect your insight, your intuitive sense with the perception and then you understand the meaning. That is a spiritual vision of the physical world. But some people can see in the energies, some people see in the desire world. And in any realm that we are in, we are capable of developing a sensitivity so that we can be objectively aware of it as though it were external to ourselves, and that is what clairvoyance is. Trained clairvoyance is someone who has gone through the discipline and has gotten a lot out of it. Like you are a trained clairvoyant in the physical world because all of those many hours that you put in photography and you have learned to see. So that you see things that other people do not see, so you are a trained physical world clairvoyant.
Well, that's kind of opposite though, because I had found something in my mind that was clairvoyant, and then I already
had that. Yes, well, what you did is you're talking about something else there. You're talking about you have brought some faculty or a sensitivity that you had in your inner consciousness, you brought that to bear on the material world, and you brought it in. And brought it all the way through. Now, when there is clairvoyance, there are various ways that it can be unfolded. There is very negative clairvoyance, and that is usually associated with people who are psychonegative. And what they are doing is, you know, like their clairvoyance is like the clairvoyance of animals. I'll give you an example from a friend I had that she had a cat, and she was a rather attractive woman. And she attracted a lot of boyfriends. And the cat always knew which boyfriend was going to be good for her and which wasn't, because the cat was bonded to her psychically, and the cat could see the nature of the boyfriend and responded accordingly. When people become fearful or psychologically negative, they wake up in atavistic clairvoyance as we used to have. And then it is a protective or self-defense mechanism, and there is usually associated with that negative clairvoyance, there is some irrational fear. Like Jean Dixon, when she was a clairvoyant, she had a very irrational fear about Russians. And you could talk to her about almost any subject, but when that came up, she just went bizarre. You know, that was symptomatic. And if a person is a negative clairvoyant, then they just have the phenomena, which is like looking with your eyes, but not really looking to see what's there or what it means. What happens is people say, oh, I see this happening, or I see this in the inner world, but I don't know what it means. If you have somebody who is a positive, controlled clairvoyant, you might not even know that they're clairvoyant. They will tell you what something means in such a way that you can get the most out of a circumstance that you're coming through or you coming to, or that you can avoid it altogether without having to be told that this is what is what. What is important is the meaning. Clairvoyance should be something not just phenomenalistic. It should be something that is a tool for getting at the meaning or purpose of something better. A lot of people in our times right now are somewhere in between. You know, most people are responsible people. They go to work every day, they're conscientious, they try to do as well as they can with their children, and by this, they're gradually building soul material. If you're a mother, you got to watch the baby. That's said that, what is it? Maybe somebody in here knows how many different cries a mother can recognize in a baby. And that is a way, you know, that is the circumstances of life without going through all kinds of meditative techniques or things like that, that they're being prepared. And they're getting the soul material. When you sacrifice for your children, you get soul material. It's the same thing as if somebody sacrifices as being, somebody that's doing spiritual work or something like that, sacrificing the whole life for the sake of other people. Well, actually, all parents are doing that same thing, and they're building up soul power. And we're very close to at least etheric clairvoyance being general property. I think all that needs is a refocus of attention for many people to be ready to have the clairvoyance. And that refocus of attention means away from the gloss of the material world. And I believe it comes the way most spiritual developments come in our life, through suffering. We have to be weaned in no uncertain terms from our materialism and our focus on indulging ourselves in entertainment or whatever we indulge ourselves in, and really trying to get with the program, that is, trying to live for the purpose of things. And so I think that the current depression is probably the beginning of a series of things that are, if you look at them materialistically, they appear to be catastrophes. But the reason that they're catastrophic is because we're so dense. And if we can get through, and if we can wake up, this is why we try to do these kinds of schools and things like that. If we can wake up without the catastrophes are unnecessary, or they're not as devastating when they are. And so I think there's likelihood of pandemia. And certainly the possibility is that the pandemia may be of human origin. I believe there are people out there that hate certain types of people or hate overpopulation and would try to kill people. And they would work genetically to that end. I don't want to talk too much about that because it is a very negative thing. But pandemia is a likelihood. I think earth changes and climate changes are a likelihood. Anything to get our attention and get us working together with each other and loving each other. Those are the kind of I've tried to work very hard on spiritual development myself, but the major changes in my character that have helped me to become a kinder person and a more loving person are the things that have been the catastrophes in my life, and the suffering and the pain and the sorrow sinks in, and it's, you can't doubt it. Especially if you know about, most of my sorrows in life came after I knew about spiritual things, so I really had to take them to heart. You know, it then becomes a very shaming thing that you have to be brought to the edge of death before you wake up to living this kind of way. But that's, I'm very glad it happened. I've had one mystical experience, and I've gone through cancer and a divorce, and I value the latter two things more than the mystical experience, because it is through them that there was significant change in my character. I probably still am too much of an SOB in some ways, but thanks to that, there is some change. I think that happens with humanity also. Yeah, it's probably...
People say that you can change the past, psychotherapeutic techniques and all this.
Yeah.
Like you can actually go mentally and alter the so-called past, so that it isn't what it was. And I find that as I'm thinking about it now in this moment, that that's not true, because it's an absolutely new moment.
Yeah. There are people that try to do things like that, and there is an attitude about the past and an attitude about the future. Basically, the past is objective. What was, was, and you can't doubt that. The future has more of a subjective, well, it could be this or it might be that. It is wrong to take the attitudes and confuse them with each other. If you're objective about the future, it's very limiting. If you say, I'm going to be this, you will be that. You can carry objectively into the future, but you'll only be that. And if you're not open to new things happening, if you're not happening to the wonder that the future is, and you're not subjectively saying, yes, oh wow, I never knew this was possible, you give yourself more of a narrow life. The past is objective. Facts are facts. And if you try to be subjective and change it and make it to something that is more personally agreeable to you, you're denying truth. And in the first place, you're participating in a personal fantasy. That what is most important is really to be able to see what the past was and to extract as much as you can. There are several memories of nature, so that not one moment of experience is ever lost. There is in the ether a memory of everything that has happened. In the world of thought, there is an even better one, and on higher spiritual levels yet, there are others. Each moment here is precious. In the life cycle, the greatest amount of time is not the amount of time that is spent here. It is the amount of time processing what we learned here the last time around and pondering what our next life is going to be, so that we don't make some stupid, dangerous kind of thing. And so, suppose we're lucky and get 90 years here. Those 90 years are nothing. It's not even one-tenth of the life cycle. And the reason the life cycle is set up that way is because you want to get the most you can out of the resources. This is the only place that we can really awaken self-consciousness. We can awaken into the spiritual worlds and the states that are in them, but to develop new waking consciousness, we can only do it here. And it's best if we even do it without remembrances of past lives, but we do it in a genuine way as if we were new kids, you know, like, wow, I just discovered this. Then it's really yours. It's not yours if you can remember it from a past life or something like that. It's yours, but in a different way. So I think that, yes, it's very dangerous. There's a whole field of psychological activities that are similar to that. A lot of them have to do with hypnotism and suggestions in hypnotism and things like that for not seeing the past as it really was. Like any time that you have to depend on any other being or any drug or any mechanism or anything outside of yourself, you really don't know that it's yours. If you're having a drug experience, it's the drug, it's not you. And this is if you draw it from your own being and you can see it free and you can see it unadulterated or uncoerced or anything like that, that's the ideal. You look like you're ready to say something.
Questioning. Because you referred to, I was thinking of the past, not over a million years, but for example, the past
5 years.
Experience, maybe yeah. The last, whatever.
10 years, yeah.
40, 50, 60, whatever years. And you're saying it's all objective, and
yes.
I think a lot of things are objective. But I would say that a lot of it is also subjective. The way we see, every person sees the past. And I think
yes.
That could be
yeah, there is,
changed. Can it not?
Yes, we can change our perception about the past, just as we change our interpretation of history. But the fact itself, and the reality itself, because what comes out of that past, when the essence of that comes into us and it becomes new causes for a new life, then it is no longer subject to interpretation. The fact that what the past gives birth to is something that can't be doubted. Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Runners.
Okay. Yes.
Right. And so there's this, I think, African woman who was way ahead of all the
yes,
other
yes, she's from South Africa.
From South Africa.
Yeah.
And so now they say, well, there's no way that a woman can be so much faster than all the other women. She has to be a male or something, though she has a birth certificate saying she's a woman. But I mean,
they even make them undergo physical examinations and DNA examinations.
Obviously, I mean, she is.
I'll give you the simplest answer, which is a very general answer and a simplistic answer. I think all the spectrum of human expression between what is male and what is female, or what is martial or what is Venusian, that is a gradated thing that is going to pass through everyone, and I don't see a really important reason for making some distinctions. What is important is how a person lives, what they do, what the integrity of their character is, not whether they're so Venusian they can't possibly be a man or something like that. I really don't care about that matter, not in the least.